Well, Peter, Mary, I want to welcome you on Generation One. As I said to you, and by way of hello, that as I am rereading your book, Evolutionary Leadership, Integral Leadership for an Increasingly Complex World, that I had the feeling that the book was getting better and better every year, or maybe I was getting a little smarter every year, but I kept saying, oh yes, oh that's so true, oh that is exactly what we need. And it was quite unusual because I have read your book once or twice before. I've taught from it several times in my various classes. And I want to welcome you especially onto this particular class called Generation One. And as you know, we named it this to represent everybody on Earth being part of one generation, facing together for the first time the possibilities of the extinction and destruction of our life support system here, or a more conscious, deliberate evolution towards a future that is new and that has not yet been fully experienced by anybody. There are no elders in Generation One who says this is how you move through high-tech, overpopulating, polluting phase of life towards sustainability, evolvability. And I would say that the Generation One class and the work we've been doing is an effort to prepare people in Generation One to be leaders in very much the way that you're calling for in evolutionary leadership. And I just want to ask you to begin with, to give us a little update on your own situation there and your work and where you're at with your efforts in evolutionary leadership and formation of various organizations that we can then draw from. But just I'd like people to know what you're doing now, where you're at, where you think the movement for a more positive future is at.
Well, thanks, Barbara, and it's an honor to be part of this this movement and this specific class. So the book, it's funny because, you know, I wrote it, what, in 2005 or so originally, and that's almost 10 years ago now, which is amazing, really, as I think about it. But, you know, when you say that it gets better every year, the thought that crossed my mind is, well, maybe the time is catching up with the book. You know, sometimes, sometimes, you know, when we write things, you're really you're kind of tuning into a higher state, and you download something that's there, and then you write it down, and then you spend the next 10 years trying to understand what you've written and actually implement what you've written.
Right, so, that's right. I'm familiar with that.
Yeah, right. Oh, that was a good idea. I should really do that. Yeah. So, I mean, that's a lot of what the last, you know, 10 years or so of my life have been about, is really taking these concepts and attempting to put them into practice and learn what it takes to really design, lead, run, prototype an organization that would do things that way. It was really, that was the impulse behind the establishment of the Center for Human Emergence over here in the Netherlands, where we said, well, let's, you know, without compromising, work out what it would take to create an integral evolutionary culture internally in the organization and deliver value to the society in a way that will help the society progress in this transition.
I see.
You know, it's been a big experiment and prototype, really, which we've learned a huge amount from. The Center for Human Emergence is still going strong here. After 7 years at the helm, I stepped out of the leadership role actually last September, and I still have a role as the founder. And, you know, they say that every 7 years, every cell in your body has been renewed, so it felt like a good moment.
And there were other things. Peter, just on that you were applying these leadership concepts within the internal organization of Emergence Group and to the larger world in your efforts to apply these principles?
Yeah, I mean, one of our core principles has really been, you know, we try it out on ourselves first, and then once we've had that experience, we then feel we've got something that we can authentically offer to the world because we can talk from experience rather than just from concept. So absolutely, that's how we've been doing it, yeah.
Well, which of these many important ideas that you have in evolutionary leadership have you found to be most successful in your own work?
That's a big question. Let me think. I mean, there are in a classic integral way, there's a cultural piece to it in terms of the kind of culture, shared values that you have in the organization. There's a structural piece to it in terms of the processes that you know, the way you actually design and run your organization. And then there's an individual leadership piece to it as well. If I look at the culture to start with, I'd say what's very important is creating a culture which is aligned behind a shared vision, a shared commitment to work towards something that is larger than any of us. Because then once that is, when people really can feel that, then, you know, they will almost, the system will almost organize itself. People will organize themselves to do what needs to be done in service of that higher goal. And then something, you know, when you've got that at the center and people are really resonant with it, then something moves the organization rather than us trying to make it happen. Like, it's mm-hmm. like, you know, the synchronicity increases. There's a kind of a shared sense of where we're going. And within that, then, there becomes, you know, a collective space of inquiry and a place where you can be really transparent and honest and open with each other, because you know you're all in it for a higher goal and you're not playing games around, you know, personal politics and trying to, you know, one trying to be better than the other or any of all that kind of stuff falls away when you can really embed and embody a higher purpose to what you're doing right at the center. And it has to be more than just words on paper. You know, people really have to feel it in their heart and soul that this is what we're about, and feel really resonant with the organization.
How did you state the shared vision? Because this is something that we're all grappling with in Generation One, because it's such a large issue. And then as people gather together, including myself in the work I'm doing, how did you articulate a shared vision for the work you're doing?
Well, I've been always very inspired by Dee Hock's work with the Chaotic organization. You know, he was founder of, CEO of Visa yes. International, and there's some basic steps in chaotic design and the power of just the chaotic concept of really trying to find a healthy dynamic balance between chaos and order, or, you know, self-organization and structure, you could say, is really the process of firstly rooting oneself in a deep unmet need in the world. So, mm-hmm. you know, What are people, society, what is the earth really feeling at the moment that is needed and that is not being supplied? Because that will be alive in people. And then if that's the unmet need we're trying to meet, then how do we start to define a vision of what it would mean for us to be meeting that need? And then a really fundamental question in terms of purpose from a chaotic design point is, so who do we as a community or an organization need to become in mm-hmm. order to fulfill that mission? Because there's no doubt in my mind and experience that who you become as a collective determines how effective you will be in the world. It really is.
Exactly right. And the practices of who you are becoming are as fundamental as what you are actually doing.
Absolutely.
You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah. They really mirror each other. I mean, it is, you know, we say from the individual level there's the kind of spiritual teachings about, you know, the boundaries between inside and out and that they don't really exist, and that we reflect that, you know, the world outside of us and reflects what's going on inside of us. Well, I think that's definitely true, but I think it's also true at a collective level. You know, we create who we are.
You know, in trying to develop a structure, when I designed the Wheel of Co-Creation, I'm putting it on my new website, evolve.org, at the hub of the wheel of all those spokes of various functions, we're calling this a new sacred space. And I've been very interested in cultivating for myself and people I'm working with and these people taking the classes, is how do we go as evolutionaries, the incarnation, you mentioned Andrew Cohen in your book, of incarnating the impulse of evolution is a kind of evolutionary spirituality that seems to be emerging here that doesn't have a name, either Buddhist, Christian, Muslim, or Jewish. It's evolutionary. And then how do you amplify the resonance of that impulse in various people's to co-create? And this is one of the real questions I wanted to ask you on the self and spiritual aspect of who we are becoming. I was interested in your mentioning in Don Beck's Spiral Dynamics the importance of that second tier, not only yellow and turquoise, but coral and teal. And I think it might be interesting for you to say something to people about how you've been using Don Beck's model, and particularly at that growing edge of itself, where it seems to be growing almost faster than we're able to research what's happening to people, because I think a lot of my students are without maybe even being aware of it, are in coral or teal. And I'd like you to just give that model briefly, and then what it means to be in second tier if you're going to be a leader, because our major subject has been evolutionary leadership. And I believe you said in your book, you really can't be a leader unless you go into second tier, because otherwise you're going to be so wedded to your own particular values that you can't lead beyond them. So let's just go into that as one of the most important models, particularly the growing edge of it.
Yeah, thanks for the question. The spiral dynamics model informed a lot of my work, and more recently I've been looking at how it may evolve as we stretch up into those other areas. But to start with the basics, you know, if we've got Claire Graves and then and Don and Chris Kalman on to identify as this first tier of six value systems, that evolved in response to a need, so there's not one is better than the other. And the question the whole time you're looking at is the value system that's active in the individual or the collective appropriate for the life conditions that they're in. So it's not we all have to get to second tier or we all have to get to teal. The question is functional fit, is a healthy relationship between interior and exterior. So you will have effective leaders at every level of the spiral, and they're effective when the value system that there's really kind of healthy in them is the appropriate value system to be leading the people they're leading to do what they want to do.
So, you want to give some examples of, you know, the red and blue and briefly.
Yeah, I mean, for example, I was doing some organizational consulting in a big IT company, and some of the senior managers who were, you know, very kind of steeped and excited about the green value system of collaboration and sharing and everything else were looking to encourage self-organizing teams. They wanted people to kind of take more responsibility and self-organize in this delivery department. And this delivery department was a department that just had to get stuff done, you know, and get things shipped to clients and everything else. And when I had them literate in the spiral, said to them, well, if these are the things they need to be doing, like this kind of work, which value system do you think best supports that kind of work? And they kind of stopped and thought, said, well, the blue value system, it's all about structure and order and authority and know your place and do what you need to do and know what the rules are and everything else. And I said, absolutely. You know, the last thing you want is kind of green value system dominant in that kind of environment. You need a healthy blue value system. And so there was this kind of light went on, and they realized that they were projecting their own value system onto that context, where the question is, given the function which those people need to perform, what's the matching value system that would best support that? Mm-hmm. And so that's, you know, the second tier awareness gives us that awareness where we're not attached to any one of the value systems, but we're continually asking ourselves, you know, given that what life is wanting to make happen here, what's the best fit with the value system and therefore the best people who can be in that context. So it very clearly is not about, well, you know, second tier or one of the more complex value systems is better than the other. The question the whole time we need to ask is, what do the life conditions ask of us, and what kind of value system do the life conditions need for us to be able to engage it effectively? Now, having said that, the planetary life conditions that we're in right now contain a level of complexity that is too complex for any of those first-tier systems to deal with, which is precisely the reason that the second-tier value systems have emerged, because the complexity of the life conditions has triggered this growth of consciousness in us to try to engage these more complex realities that we're facing. So that's, you can have leaders at all of those levels, but are what I described as evolutionary leaders who have a perception of the whole, who can see the bigger picture, and but also can delve down into the granularity of the earlier levels without judgment, but are continually asking themselves what's appropriate, you know, for life in this place at this time now, and how do we support that fit. That's really the, in a way, it's a deep compassion to it, but there's also a very clear functionality to it.
Yes. So when I was reading your descriptions of second tier, starting with yellow, which is basically the ability to see system as a whole, and then going into, could you briefly describe the understanding of, I think it's turquoise, coral, and teal, as values that seem to be emerging?
So integral, you know, is the first time you begin to see that, you know, kind of take a distance from your own worldview, as it were, and notice your own path and see the different pieces that make up your journey and therefore enable you to engage them with greater compassion in the world. And mm-hmm. It's yellow is still quite a cognitive system. It's really kind of systems thinking and mapping everything out, and at some point all of that becomes too much for the cognition. And we get that there's a whole, but we also experience that we can never hold that whole in our cognitive mm-hmm. knowing. And mm-hmm. that's really when turquoise begins to come online, and we develop a different way of knowing the whole, which is more experiential or intuitive than cognitive. And in my more recent work, since I wrote the book, what I've really come to see is that actually I think that turquoise number 8 system acts like an octave, like an octave on the piano. It kind of wraps up a set of 8. And almost integrates all of the others through that last octave note and provides a kind of a sealing, as in S-E-A-L, a seal to that set, and then something else is going to emerge out of that. So I would actually say that...
Out of the turquoise.
Yeah, and out of that, mm-hmm. out of that whole phase, it's like the seed has grown into a fruit, and then that yes. fruit's becoming the... and so I think maybe when I wrote the book, when I was talking about coral and teal, to be honest, it wasn't based in my experience. I was kind of, I think I even admitted in the book, it was a projection out of the pattern that I was seeing, you know, further in the spiral. And so it may be true, But I think what happens at Turquoise is that something really, in terms of the individual development, something is really healed or made whole in mm-hmm. in the human being. You know, we clean up lots of trauma and stuff from our early stages of development and somehow click in to a new level that prepares us for this next phase that we're going to engage.
Yes.
You know, the characteristics of Turquoise and is more intuitive and feeling of the whole is that we begin to experience reality as really one big flow space of energy. So we understand that everything is energy, even the material things that we're looking at are just dense forms of energy. And therefore, mm-hmm. everything is connected and is interrelated, become more aware of, you know, earth-based energies, energies around our bodies, energies in organizations and nature. So we begin to, you know, feel more of reality rather than just the stuff that we can see with our eyes. Mm-hmm.
You know, I was talking recently with Irvin Laszlo, and he's mm-hmm. been a great student of what he calls the Akashic Field, and recently or currently is writing a book called Akashic Science. And it's basically the science of coherence at a universal scale. Entanglement and going into quantum physics with the understanding of the coherence that seems to be manifesting at all levels, which I'm very fascinated with that, because if that is, that seems to be true at some levels, then it would mean also that as we approach more and more of this crisis together, no matter what part of the spiral dynamics we're on, we could be a warlord in Afghanistan or we could be, you know, an environmentalist in Berkeley, you're still going to be facing a similar set of crises. And it may well be that the penetrating into the universal coherence is going as a species, could become a species-wide, at least, sensibility.
Mm-hmm.
Given the fact of having a species-wide crisis, no matter what stage you're at, you know, it might be something new to have a shared crisis of this order, as well as maybe shared possibilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it might, and maybe it's useful to distinguish between, you know, states and stages here, where you know, we may all start to get greater access to a state of coherence that experience we then translate into our own stage of development. But having that state experience might increase the speed with which we move through different stages until we've actually embodied, you know, that state experience to become a stage. So we've actually turned it into a structure of consciousness that we don't just pop in and out of, but that we hold permanently in the way of our lives.
Yes, I have a little book called 52 Codes for Conscious Evolution that have just been guides for me, and one of them has these four words. The first is consolidate all aspects of your being. So that would be like what you're saying. And the second word is substantiate. To feel substantial in what of the higher frequencies of insights, as well as in your body as a whole being. And then there's the hardest one for me is self-calibrate. When there's so many, if you're an evolutionary person, there are lots of places you see there are many unmet needs. There's nothing but unmet needs. And you are one person, and then how do you know? Something I'd like to dwell with you a little bit in the evolutionary leadership sort of container is how that calling or vocation gets recognized and becomes a guide for you, no matter what stage you're at, if you have any freedom at all. you really, it seems to me that one of the great needs of modern society is to be able to tune into that inner calling.
Mm-hmm.
Say yes to it and then develop it in a sort of self-rewarding way, as in Maslow's hierarchy, where the doing of it is rewarding and of service. I mean, that's a goal that we're aiming at in our class, is to help ourselves identify. And sometimes there's so many things you could do. How do you tune in?
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of a quote from, I think, really from one of the ancients, where they say it's where your passion meets a need in the world, there lies your vocation.
Yes,
and
yes.
I think that's completely it. You know, it's not either just, well, what do you feel like doing? And it's also not just, what does the world need done? But where do those two meet? And right, self-calibration is a good way of framing it. How do we actually learn to recognize in ourselves the resonance with our calling, really, with our vocation, which is what it literally means.
Yes, and testing it out. And then the fourth one of these words is a really beautiful word, concelebrate. And the meaning of that is to give thanks and celebrate that you happen to be alive at the exact moment when the human species is aware, in many of its members at least, that we are living through a planetary shift. And that to some amazing, miraculous thing, we have something to do with it. Here it is in this book. Celebrate with yourself, with others, with the great creating process and the universe itself, the great privilege of being born at the time of a planetary emergence, with the consciousness to know that you are part of it, participating in the co-creation of a more universal species. So the final one is, I really do appreciate to do this because it's easy to get sort of heavy with the weight of never being able to do enough about whatever it is that you think you're doing.
The piece about how do you find your purpose or vocation, something occurs to me that's been important in my experience as I look back is not to get stuck in continually the question of what's the great big thing that I'm going to achieve in my life and kind of put everything else off until that shows up, because actually we are given little steps to take on the way to that, and it's through the moment we kind of tune in and feel like, is this the thing I should be doing next, even if it's just for the next moment or the next week or the next, you know, months, okay. This may not be but this feels like the right next step. It gives me energy when I tune into it. You know, okay, I'll do this. And then by engaging in that, through that process, our next step reveals itself, and the next step reveals itself. And we end up somewhere we could never even thought of, you know, when we were started asking the question. But the path unfolds as long as we're continually asking ourselves, you know, really, where is my heart telling me to go? And, okay, this isn't a great big thing, but it certainly feels like the next right step for me, so let me take it fully and then see what life has to offer after that. Otherwise, we can get too hung up the whole time, but this isn't it, that's not it. You know, well, it will reveal itself when you walk the path, but it won't reveal itself as you kind of sit in on your meditation cushion asking yourself, you know, when's it coming?
You know, the word trust comes to me as you're speaking, is to trust in that your own inner guidance in doing what you can do when you're doing it, and the trust in the larger process itself, which seems to have an amazing tendency to optimize for billions of years. You know, I was listening to this beautiful talk of Justin Rosenstein. He's doing a big project called One Project, and he says at this conference, he said, you know, I absolutely love the universe. And the very fact that I should be walking around in it is is beyond, you know, that is at the biggest possible scale, the awesome mystery. So then on the immediate thing that I might be able to do today and tomorrow, while coded with that awareness that you're part of truly an awesome mystery, the mystery of how nature has gone from nothing at all through the ever more increasing complexity, to us being living through that, the mystery and awesome reality of that understanding applied.
Yeah, I think that is. I think that's a really key point, and there's so much to it. It's something I've really been feeling into the last time. And, you know, scientifically, we can make the case as well, because the scientists can only explain 4% of the universe. So, you know, what's going on in that other 96%? And so we can trust that, you know, there's more at play than we can actually see or understand. And, you know, one of the practices I've been developing recently is, you know, talking about more of the energetic work, is the work developed by Michelle Small-Wright at the Perelandra organization. You know, a very conscious approach to working with the invisible realms in your daily practice, and really inviting in life to co-create with you. So the big relief when I came across it was, you know, this idea that, you know, part of the human's role is to be clear on our intention and express our free will about the direction, definition, and purpose of what we're doing. But then we kind of fell into the trap of thinking that we needed to work out how to do that and how to manifest that. Whereas actually, it's nature, as she would call it, or life, or, you know, the devas and the nature spirits who are coded with how to create those forms in a way that is most coherent with life. And we, you know, we don't need to work it all out. We need to be clear on our intention, stay completely present, and notice how life is starting to shape itself around that intention, and then align ourselves with that. And that's such a relief when you kind of go, God, I don't need to work out how to do it all.
Yes, that's beautiful. It's really beautiful. Yes, and there's also that inner biofeedback that can signal you when you're overly tense or overly structured or overly, you know, I don't know, compulsive. I mean, that's something that I think what you're saying, I can see that you've practiced that in such a way that it really serves you. I can hear it in you, because you're fully purposeful, and at the same time there's a certain lightness and humor and joy in it. It's a signal. I wanted to ask you about the communities of practice, and particularly the circles, because we have, let me just turn this off, we have been inviting people on Generation 1 to form circles, which they are doing throughout this whole course, the same people in the circles for these 12 weeks. And then we've developed a little Evolve Pack to invite them, if they want to go to their neighborhoods and their friends with these ideas and show a movie or have a conversation around conscious evolution and this whole set of concepts. So I'm seeing that the small circle and the hub are structures of community that are really important if you're an evolutionary and you don't belong to some big church or institutional religion, which most evolutionaries do not. The whole question of community and circle building and the formation of communities is very important.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things we need to remember is that we can't do this on our own. We can't change ourselves or develop ourselves on our own, and we're not going to be able to impact the world in the way we want to on our own. So how we find others who one complement the skills and qualities that we have, and to help mirror back to us the pieces that we need to clear up, which isn't always a comfortable process, but is essential. It's very important, you know, and that feeling of being able to build that sense of trust and belonging with each other that enables you to be more vulnerable and open up and dig deeper, but also builds the energy to be able to make an impact. I think it's very, very important. And what we noticed in our work with the Center for Human Emergence is that there really are stages in the development of those circles or collectives, from initially being a network of people who are kind of just getting to know each other, and then moving into a community of practice where you really define a shared practice with each other. So it's okay, so this is the work we're trying to do. We're trying to do the same thing. And how are you experiencing, and what's working for you, and what's not working, and what can we learn from each other about this practice that we're all engaged in? And then you notice that after that's been happening for a while, some extra coherence enters the circle, and that community of practice is ready to shift into being what Margaret Wheatley would call a system of influence. So it's ready to actually act collectively on the world. Whereas as a community of practice, what you've been doing is learning with each other and then going back and doing your own thing and bringing that experience back in and continuing to learn, which is very important. But then at some point something clicks in and it's like, wow, now that we've kind of got a sense of who each of us are, we've built the trust and vulnerability through the community of practice, we could now actually, if we combined our efforts, you know, really have an impact that would be greater than the sum of the parts. And that's when it really kind of begins to shift. So it's very interesting to, you know, we've seen that happen through these communities of practice we were stimulating at the CHE here, and thinking through what are the conditions, you know, that need to be in place to help the community, that circle, move through these phases to becoming a system of influence. So it is, it's absolutely key, yeah.
Yes, because we are, one of my goals is to create a space for evolutionary community to self-organize on the evolve.org website, because in the way I've been doing it, that was teaching on internet, but there hasn't been enough contact, and there's been some self-organizing among various members of this particular community, but the community itself hasn't cohered to become something that could do exactly what you're saying, have some common practices and common goals. So that's the stage we're at with the formation of communities of evolutionaries.
Sorry, go ahead. Yeah, I was just going to say that's very, it's very relevant to what I'm engaged in right now, because since, you know, really the last year of my life has been devoted to a new project called Ubiquity University, where we're kind of trying to do pretty similar to what you described just now, which is how do we build a global learning and innovation community that also offers university degrees and stuff, but is essentially in service of learning what we need to learn to bring our own passion into the world to be of service to humanity at this time. And a key, you know, one of the big developments certainly in the U.S. has been these MOOCs, you know, these massively open online courses, as the whole higher education system is being significantly disrupted right now. But as you look at those, a lot of them are really kind of talking heads still on a screen. Yeah. And there's very little support for the kind of collaboration you've been talking about. So we're very lucky to have a really super chief technology officer who knows that whole social world very well, and is creating a kind of Facebook-style collaboration environment that that really is going to make the difference between just, you know, listening to stuff to enabling the creativity and collaboration that are so important as capacities to develop in ourselves. To really weave in that social dimension to the learning environment, I think is going to be critical to our collective capacity to, you know, solve and engage with some of these global challenges.
Can you tell me his name?
Okay. His name is Griffin DeLuce, L-U-C-E. I'm happy to put you in touch with, you know, if you like. But
I would like that.
On a parallel track, Barbara, there might just be a nice bit of synchronicity between Ubiquities, the platform that we're building, and an ability to serve the Generation One community through that platform. But we can discuss that offline.
That would be very, very interesting. Is that what was Wisdom University?
Yeah, so Wisdom University gave birth, in a way, to Ubiquity and has now become the Wisdom School within Ubiquity University.
I see. Oh, very good.
Yeah.
It's a whole new formation. Well, I knew Jim Garrison quite well and did some work at Wisdom University, but haven't for a while. I appreciate being put in touch with him. I think that we seem to have be double talking here, and it's almost time to say goodbye anyway. Let's see if we have a final word here that you would like to offer to Generation One students and Generation One people in general, you know, to give us your inspiration.
Well, you know, really what I've learned the last few years is, as I guess, pushed into what Turquoise, this kind of holistic value system, really means, is, and tried to make sense of it for myself, is the way I've made sense of it is really by talking about three architectures at which we can engage in organization and leadership. And there's the material architecture, which is, you know, the place we really manifest stuff, results, and the structures and the products and everything else. And that is held in what I call the relational architecture. And that's the field of relationships between the people and the parts within the system that enables the manifestation into the material. And that's what a lot of the work with Theory U and the Art of Hosting and other approaches has been focused on, you know, over the last 10, 15 years, is really creating coherent relational architecture in our organizations to ensure that the material results that we create are as coherent and effective as possible. Now, there's a layer to add to that is what I've found in the last few years, and that's what I call the energetic architecture. You know, because anything which has a name and a boundary has an energy body, in my experience, in the same way that, you know, we're pretty comfortable with saying, well, around my physical body there are various layers of energetic, subtle energy bodies. So an organization has an energetic architecture. So a piece of land which has a boundary and a name has an energetic architecture. And you can, you know, I've been part of a four-year vocational training here in the Netherlands by the Center of Ecotherapy that really teaches you how to contact, engage with, and contribute to and enhance the energetic architecture of large-scale systems. And realizing that, realizing that if we can learn to work at the energy level of the energetic architecture as well, it greatly speeds up the coherence in the relational field and therefore in the material field.
How do you affect the energetic? How do you do that? I mean, in terms of like a daily practice or relational practice.
Well, it's a longer. If we want to go into that now, we can. It'll take me a few minutes to explain, but I'm happy to if you like.
I think we should just explain it and then we'll end.
Okay, I mean so you imagine you've got a, let's take a piece of land or an organization, and just by either creating a miniature version of the map or of the floor plan of the organization, or even just the name of the organization, a piece of paper with a ring around it, that creates what we call a resonator, and through that you can get in touch with the organization's energetic field. And by agreeing on a shared language, which you do through this training process, you can assess different energetic parameters. So we use a lot of the Wilhelm Reich terms, like Orgon, which means kind of life energy, Or and Dordenor, which is blocked energy, how grounded is the system. So it's like going to the doctor, really. You just kind of take a health check. In the context of a set of goals, that's what it, that, you know, the guardian or the steward of that system is wanting to achieve over a number over a year or so. So you have a time frame and you have goals, and then you assess the fitness of the system energetically. And then you ask it, you know, so this is what you're wanting to do, and this is where you're wanting to go, and this is the current state of play. You know, what intervention do you need next? And it might say, oh, I need some grounding. You know, it's okay, grounding, good. I have these different symbols that help with grounding. And which one is works best? And this is all done with dowsing.
I see.
So you then asking and checking. Yeah. And then it says, I need this symbol. So you say, okay, great, this symbol. How many days a week do you want this symbol? It's like taking a pill in a way. This symbol, I'll have it 5 days a week, please, and 2 minutes each time. So basically, you know, what you do is you have your map, as it were, on a piece of paper, and then you have your symbol, and you quite simply put the symbol on the map, and with your intention, you just let them talk to each other for the 2 minutes, and then you take it off. And what happens is that those fields start to interact with each other. So the energy of the symbol that helps grounding starts to interact with the energetic field of the system that you're working with. And you check in and you say, well, when do you need us to check in again? And they say, well, 10 days, let's say. And so 10 days later, you check in with the energetic values and you notice what's changed. And hopefully the grounding has increased. And then you ask what's next. And so gradually, you know, often over a 6 to 9 month process, the energetic values of the system come into greater coherence. And at the same time, you're working with the steward of the system, which might be the CEO of the organization or the warden of the piece of land, and helping them to, you know, work with visualization and affirmation, but also track the developments on the ground and seeing how they actually relate to the developments in the energetic architecture.
Beautiful.
Yeah, it really works. You know, that's the thing. Yeah, it's called ecotherapy. In the Netherlands, they're looking to change the name probably to eco-intention because of the confusion in the English-speaking world around ecotherapy, which is more of a psychology process, you know, in nature. But yeah, if you go to ecotherapy.org, then that gives you some more information on that. But you know, these are the kind of practices that are really emerging right now that take the kind of concepts that Irvin Laszlo talks about, and Rupert Sheldrake and Lynn McTaggart and all of this stuff, and gives you a practice which you can learn to actually apply those to societal, organizational development and coherence. So it's really, I think it's a real breakthrough that these kind of practices are beginning to emerge right now that allow us to work at the energetic level with that 96% of reality that the science is not really explaining.
I think that this has been so fruitful for us to hear from you. I would like to go back to school myself, you know, because when you think of what it was like in 1929 when I was born, and the arc of the personal evolution that we're going through, particularly if we're older, is it really almost like a species-wide arc. And to find now to reconnect or to connect for the first time in a long while with people who are right at the growing edge of this arc, for members of Generation One, this has been a very valuable conversation. I thank you so much. I look forward to talking with you, meeting with you again. I hope one of these days when I get to the Netherlands or you get to California, be sure to let me know.
Okay.
And just thank you so much. And I would like to have the contact with that gentleman who's working with Ubiquity. Deluce, I think.
Okay. Well, we can get back in touch about that. But thanks for the... thanks for the invitation again, Barbara, and best of luck with this initiative and to everyone who's listening. You know, definitely now's the time.
Yes, thank you so much. I appreciate it very much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now.